Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, if you've been listening for a while to American Variety, you've probably recognized that we're kind of partial to adventurers. I remember one British guy who sailed a small boat single-handed across the Atlantic. And when I say single-handed, I mean that literally. He had one arm, and he had some harrowing adventures in the course of it, but he made it, obviously. He was on my show later. There was a guy who a few years earlier had gone with a friend of his into the heart of the biggest jungle in the Congo in search of something called, as I recall, Mekele Mbembe. I don't know if I said that right, but anyway, close enough. And it was kind of a sort of the Loch Ness monster of Central Africa. I guess this was a legendary thing among the tribes there that this thing actually existed and was some sort of a, you know, sort of a dinosaur, basically. And he went days and days into this jungle on a foolhardy expedition looking for this thing. I guess they encountered all kind of poisonous snakes and angry monkeys and stuff, but no Mekele Mbembe. But it was an interesting tale. It was years ago. I talked with him on the radio show about it. But, you know, there's a fellow who has been on a number of expeditions looking for the crash site of Amelia Earhart that involves a lot of research and then deep diving and remotely operated vehicles and that kind of thing. And they think they've found it, actually. But there's a fellow who would go into the lead an expedition, a series of them, into jungles in the South Pacific looking for downed World War II aircraft and their crews with the idea of bringing back those missing in action bodies to the U.S. to be interred. And to their loved ones. And they found many of them. And I mean, those were some ghoulish stories. I mean, you know, where the aircraft was hanging in the trees and the bodies of the crew were strapped into their seats 50 years later. It was not a fun sight, right? But they were successful at doing that, and it was a really good thing to do. Had astronauts on. I mean, they've had a lot of scientists of various kinds on over the years. But we've never had a scientist who was an adventurer until this week. Professor Robert Walker is a geographer and ecologist at the University of Florida, who goes deep into the Amazon, where law and order really doesn't exist, to do research that could easily get him killed. He's kind of a real-life Indiana Jones, but without, you know, the Ark of the Covenant or the Hollywood glitz that goes along with it. Welcome, Dr. Walker.
Hello, Court, and thank you very much for the invitation.
Thanks for being on. Can we call you Bob?
Yeah, please do.
So now that I've piqued their curiosity, Bob, why don't you tell us what it is you do?
Well, what I do is, well, as you say, go into the Amazonian forests. My particular interest is what we refer to as land chain science. And so that covers a broad category of phenomena, such as logging the hardwoods out of the forest or converting the forest to agricultural landscape. So it's somewhat of a broad spectrum of research topics. Now, my particular interest is in understanding the what we call the human drivers of land change, or deforestation in this case. And I approach it from a social science perspective, trying to understand the human behaviors and social processes. Now, having said that, I'm very interested in the ecological implications, what this means for biodiversity, carbon sequestration, and the like. Now, as for what we actually do from a methodological perspective, we go into the forest, we conduct scientific surveys, very much akin to ethnographic research. We return from the field to the computer labs, upload all the data, and then combine it with imagery from satellites that provide good records of what's happened with respect to the forest. And then we put it all together in a statistical analysis that would lead to the scientific conclusions, which we then publish in papers.
Yeah, so I think you look in a broad gauge way at the impact of logging on the region, but one article I read was you were investigating the impact of logging roads themselves, you know, just the one aspect of logging, which is cutting the road through the jungle out to where they're going to be cutting the trees. So, like, what, in a kind of a thumbnail version, what's the impact of logging roads on the region?
Well, there are two very significant impacts, one which is short run and one which is long run. In the first case, the logging roads imprint a pattern of land clearance on the landscape, and they divide the forests into what we call fragments, leading to a mosaic of fragments where separate pieces of the forest are divided in such a way that they don't communicate with each other. Now, this has a very significant impact on ecological function. There have been scientists who have observed that within a certain distance of a road, say 10 meters to 100 meters to 1,000 meters, you see a progressive decline in biomass. You see a decline in species diversity. And so it's there's a significant impact on biodiversity in the short term, given the fragmentation of the landscapes. And it's the logging roads, quite honestly, that that accomplished this. Now, as for the longer term, the logging roads, loggers go in and get the wood and leave pretty quickly, but the roads remain, and they become points of access for what have been referred to as follow-on farmers, or in the Brazilian case, colonists. They're typically small and poor individuals who, without much opportunity elsewhere, who come into the forest and look to stake a claim. And they advance the roads on the one hand, and then they cut down the trees that the loggers haven't taken on the other, and in effect accomplish deforestation, which comes after the initial fragmentation by the loggers.
It reminds me of, I'm old enough, just barely, to remember when Tamiami Trail was cut through the Everglades from Miami to the west coast of Florida, and going out there as a little kid, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, across that with my parents. And it basically, you know, it took the slow-flowing, shallow river of grass coming down from Lake Okeechobee, you know, into the tip of Florida, and cut it in half in a similar kind of way. It reminds me of that. It made a dam, basically, across that river. And
you're exactly right.
You could see after a while that on the north side of it, it was wetter than on the south side, which progressively got drier. I mean, you could really see that in a couple of years. And what was amazing to us as little kids, right, would be that we'd drive along and there were, you know, 14-foot alligators and moccasins and so on lying on the road, sunning themselves on this sudden piece of high ground that was warm. And you had to kind of very carefully drive around these giant alligators. And, of course, that was ticklish to us as, you know, 4 or 5 year olds. But, yeah, so go ahead. I mean, it's a similar analogy for that, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example. The impact on the ecological function would have a different mechanism there. You know, it would be the impoundment of the surface sheet flow and the mm-hmm. Everglades overflow from Okeechobee down to Shark River. So, yeah, and it would impede the ecological function, the connectivity between north of the trail and south of the trail. So that would be a short-run effect, which would be sustained, of course. But then if you look at the economic growth that it enabled, say, mm-hmm. from the east around Homestead, from the west through Naples in that area, that part of Florida, the south and southwest, had rates of natural areas conversion that exceeded tropical deforestation in the 1980s, probably an aftermath of the building of the Tamiami Trail and then, what is it, I-75 that cuts across to the north.
Alligator Alley and so on.
Yeah, Alligator Alley. So you see the two impacts there, the short run and the long run.
So what about the logging itself? Obviously, I think we're all familiar with the idea of clear-cutting the forest there. I mean, the Amazon is huge, but what's the impact of the logging initially that the loggers do? I heard you say that the follow-on farmers expand that and make it worse, but what's it like? I mean, do they just totally clear-cut it right down to the dirt, large areas, or what goes on there?
No, it's the forest is, I mean, if you look at tropical forests worldwide, you have differences in the concentrations of valuable species. And so, for example, in the Indonesian forests, the hardwoods that were valuable tended to grow in clustered stands that were quite extensive. And so when the loggers went in there, they clear cut and took it all out. So you have a lot of exposure to wind and rain and get a lot of erosion. And so there are impacts on the rivers. Now, in the Amazon, you have that at micro scale. Some of the mahogany tends to be clustered, but by and large, much of the logging is highly selective in the sense that there's a huge speciation of tropical hardwoods in the Amazon. And so when a logger goes in, they might only find one or two specimens per hectare that they could sell after having taken it out and sawn it. And so what happens is when they cut the trees, that individual tree, there's a lot of collateral damage. It's become somewhat analogous to the Indonesian case in this regard. The damage comes by virtue of the connection between the trees by virtue of vines, what are called in the forest there lianas. And so they basically tie the trees together, you know, as if rope had bound them mm-hmm. from limb to limb. And when you knock one down, down come others. And you get a huge collateral damage of non-marketable tree specimens that just then lie in the fields and die and wither away.
How do you get in there? Are these roads always passable, or are they, you know, one giant mud hole for 100 miles, or what's that like?
Well, I have to answer that question. Actually, you've actually asked me two questions, because they're two very significantly different types of roads. They're the roads that the federal government built, the big ones, such as the Trans-Amazon Highway, BR-230, BR-163, or the so-called Soybean Highway. These are pretty big roads. They're, for the most part, not paved. For most of the time I've worked on them, they aren't paved. And so you literally have a situation where you can only work in these parts of the Amazon during dry season. And so that can be, say, from May to November, because in the rainy season, they're literally impassable. So that you get a restriction on the research, the time during which you can do research.
Right.
And even then, depending on where you are, if you go far enough west on the Trans-Amazon, the dry season becomes practically non-existent. And so the roads can be in really bad condition even through the dry season. And so I drove once from a town called Umaita, which is on the Madeira River, 200 kilometers west, to a town on the Purus River. It's the tail end in the west of the Trans-Amazon Highway, and it literally took us, 200 kilometers took us a long, long time because the road was absolutely slick. And we had a professional driver with us, so we couldn't have done it on our own. Okay, those are the big roads. Now, the logging roads themselves, you know, they can be passable or impassable. They have the same problem with rainy and dry season, moisture conditions. Now, in the dry season, passability depends on the extent to which the road has been used in the recent past, because the forest will encroach pretty quickly. If loggers are using it, they tend to keep it in reasonably good shape, but once they've left, you get a lot of erosion and it can become impassable. So it's somewhat a flip of the coin whether one or the other will be passable. Now, in the work we do, we often look for roads that are actively being used, and so we're able to enter them for the most part.
You talked about having a driver, but you said we, so who do you travel with? Do you have like a local guide, or is there another researcher from down there, or what's the story with that?
Well, it depends. I've always worked with Brazilian colleagues. For the most part, we don't go with local guides. One of my colleagues, Eugenio Rima, is a Brazilian who's a tenured professor at the University of Texas in Austin, and he knows the Amazonia better than any guide would know it. Rita Maria Pereira, who works in Belém at the NGO Imazone, is also a very experienced field person with a great deal of exposure and experience in the Amazon. These are the people I've worked with most recently, but I've worked with Brazilians in the what's called Embrapa, which is essentially Brazil's version of the USDA. And so it'll be some combination of us, either university researchers or individuals, typically agronomists from Brazilian agencies that form field crews. And then depending on what we're doing, we'll hire teams to administer interviews. These will typically be Brazilian graduate students from Brazilian universities, although sometimes we'll bring down American students as well.
All right. So where you're going there is logging camps out on the frontier, where they're at the ends of these roads. They're doing the logging that they cut the road to get at. And so I was wondering how do the company managers and camp overseers, or whatever they'd be called, treat you? I mean, you're coming in as a researcher. Are they super suspicious? How do you handle them, and how do they handle you?
Sure. A couple of answers. One is that there are two types of settings that we would be interested in. We're primarily interested in the sawmill. So, you know, that will typically be an operation, somewhat capitalized. There'll be managers who have some modicum of education. They bring the logs in, or the logs are driven to them from logging camps, which can be pretty far up the road. And these can be different. They're different by nature of the people who are out there, by nature of their jobs. Hmm. In the past, I would say the answer depends on the time period for which I respond. And in the beginning, when I began my work down there in the 90s, you know, you could go anywhere and there was not much problem. We did a lot of interviews on sawmill properties. We traveled through logging camps. Our prime interest was in the sawmills, because there they would have records of the number of trees cut, the number of bulldozers they needed to, you know, build roads, that sort of thing. And there was really no problem talking to people. There were so few people out there, it would often be welcoming. This changed radically in, I would say, maybe about 10 years ago. And the loggers became highly sensitized to environmentalists, whether they be, foreign or domestic. The Brazilian government began cracking down on illegal logging, and so there was a huge amount of uncertainty and suspicion in the rural areas. There was also, the Great Recession put a lot of them out of jobs, and so since then, I mean, it's very, very hard to visit a sawmill. What you can do, we've been turned away, threatened, you know, been quite frightened, frankly. You know, a lot of the data that we get will come from individuals who live in the towns who work for the sawmills. For example, they may hire a forest consultant to help planning a road network, or they may hire someone to help them figure out which trees are profitable to cut, that sort of thing. Hmm. And so more recently, we've been collecting data from individuals like this. That doesn't mean we don't try to get down the roads, and we do go down the roads, you know, hoping that we can, you know, find a logger who's forthcoming. But as I say, they've been quite nervous and not always friendly to outsiders over the past 5 to 10 years.
Can imagine. Do you always make it clear, Bob, what the nature of your research or the purpose for your visit is? I mean, you could wind up sleeping with the piranhas and no one would ever know what happened to you, you know?
Yeah, no, we do. Our research projects typically have a fairly narrow analytical focus. So, for example, we may be interested, most recently would be a good example, support from the National Science Foundation. We were interested in how the logging road networks expand and what sorts of patterns they form, how much it costs to build the roads, what motivates logging decisions. So, you know, it's very technical. Now, that's not to say that we aren't concerned about the forest or have environmental leanings, but the research itself is rather technical and oriented towards modeling, you know, in the interest of informing government policy. Now, having said that, it really doesn't matter in many cases what you do or do not do or what you believe or do not believe. The fact of the matter is it's the loggers who are so concerned about, I don't know, heavy-handed government policy or surveillance on part of the government or just, you know, a bunch of irritating environmentalists that
right.
The minute they see someone who's not from the region, who has a laptop and or a backpack driving a reasonably
new vehicle,
a vehicle that looks like you can get across the road, you know, getting 3 flat tires. They assume that you're there for no good reason. They assume that you're an environmentalist or someone working for the government trying to find illegal logging. And they will be quite hostile if they, you know, have strong feelings in that direction.
Yeah, that's what I asked. I mean, you're sticking your neck out every time you go there, no matter what you tell them. And, you know, basically, these are people who think their livelihood's at stake, and you're the enemy no matter what you are because you're an outsider.
That's a pretty fair description.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Robert Walker. He's a geographer, and I guess I'd call you an ecologist from the University of Florida, who goes down into Amazonia, the Amazon River and jungle area to investigate logging and look at the impact of logging and logging roads on Amazon, and he does it kind of from an economic perspective. Interesting take on it. So I wanted to kind of switch gears, Bob, and ask you, how do these friendly folks down there treat the local indigenous people? Are their contacts with previously uncontacted tribes generally benign, or are they violent? I mean, you know, do they shoot on sight, or what's their attitude toward them?
But I should explain that just a little bit. Then I'll go on to the, your question. I'm what's called a human geographer, which means I'm focused on the social issues, the social processes that underlie any sort of environmental circumstance. In this case, because I'm also interested in the environment. Now, having said that, I have a master's degree in systems ecology, and so I also bring ecological expertise into the field, but my PhD was in social sciences. I did my degree at the University of Pennsylvania in what's called regional science, which is basically a mix of economics and planning. So anyway, I would say social science research aimed at understanding ecological outcomes. So your question about the Amerindians, it's interesting. There's a huge amount of regional variation on this score. And I'm thinking of, in particular, well, the Kayapo have been, the most aggressive in defending their homelands. If you look at the Kayapo, you can find, and you get the diversity of relationships here. We were in a place called South Felix do Xingu a couple of years ago and interviewed some of the Kayapo caciques, our chiefs. And we asked them pointedly about their relationships with loggers. And with the ones we talked to, they had achieved a certain accord whereby the loggers could come in with their equipment, take the logs, and then there'd be profit sharing. So it was somewhat amicable. They no longer have these relationships with the loggers because the logging frontier has moved out of South Felix do Xingu. But they did have somewhat of an amicable relationship. Now, having said that, you know, it depends on time and place, and the Kayapo are by no means a monolithic tribe. I've been in a place called Heidan Sao, which is south and southeast of not that far even, maybe 100 kilometers south of South Felix, and spoken with loggers who were frightened of the Kayapo. And I remember specifically interviewing one of these loggers who had on occasion gone into the Kaiapo lands to take timber and was no longer doing it. And I asked him why. He said, well, we respect the Kaiapo. And that wasn't an adequate answer. So I probed him a little further, and he finally admitted that, well, you go onto Kaiapo land, they kill you. I don't doubt it. I think there have, well, I know there have been violent interactions between loggers and indigenous peoples. It's not just the loggers. Perhaps gold miners are more likely to invade the indigenous areas because they aren't as constrained by an existing road network. They can just walk into wherever they think there's gold. So there has been a lot of violence. There has been a great deal of encroachment on indigenous areas. So I would say on balance overall that these sorts of relationships and interactions have worked against the indigenous people, and that there's been more violence than peaceful exchanges, in that many resources have been taken out of indigenous homelands that should have remained there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the Amerindians have been able, at least in some cases, in some places, to get the respect of the invaders, and and at least it'll slow down the invasion, I suppose. But
well, you do see this. If you look at satellite imagery, it's not always the case. It depends on, in some respects, on the remoteness of the group. So, for example, a group called the Tembe, which is in the northeast of Pará State, not that far from Belém, which is the big city at the mouth of the Amazon, their indigenous areas have been almost completely overrun. And in fact, I've actually traveled through Tembe territory with the invaders, who were, you know, not ashamed to admit what they were doing. On the other hand, when you get far enough away, and if you look at satellite imagery, you'll see this, and a really dramatic example is with the Uruguayawau in the state of Hondonia. You'll see a road, BR-364. It connects Cuiabá with Puerto Velho in Hondonia State. And from this road, you'll see settlement, they call them picadas, which go maybe 20 kilometers off the main road. And then they stop abruptly, and you'll see, you know, very large, geometrically shaped green area on the satellite image. And that's where these tribes have been effective in defending their native homelands. You'll see it on Earth Google. You can see it pretty easily.
I remember reading way back when, like, that in the 1960s, the Brazilian government used to drop blankets infected with smallpox down to Indian villages from small planes in an attempt to basically just exterminate them like cockroaches. So what's the Brazilian government's real attitude? Maybe the lip service attitude is maybe one thing, but what's their real attitude now toward indigenous tribes in general?
You know, it's interesting because the Brazilian government has different agencies and institutions which are tasked with different social missions. And, you know, the missions can come into conflict. So, for example, there's the group that is ostensibly concerned with protecting indigenous lands. It's called FUNAI. Many of the people who worked in FUNAI and their government individuals would never drop, you know, a smallpox-infected blanket into an indigenous area. Quite the contrary, they do their best to try to prevent anyone from doing that. Having said that, I mean, I don't think the Brazilian government, I don't know, I've never really investigated those stories, but it's hard for me to imagine that the Brazilian government would actually do that. Now, what's possible, at least the federal government, I think what's possible is that, you know, there, just as there are many parts of the world, collusion between local politicians and local developers who want a piece of land, which can lead to, you know, all manner of illegal and criminal activity. So, you know, that's not to say that the Brazilian government at the federal level doesn't want to, you know, perhaps take indigenous lands on occasion or deny the Amerindians the rights of declaring a homeland. And actually, you're seeing that at the present time. The federal government has a very significant program of development that is pursuant to what's called IRSA. It's a Continental Initiative to Integrate Infrastructure. And so, they're building dams, they're paving roads, and paying very little heed to indigenous territories. The most notable recent incident was with the Munduruku tribe on the Tapajós River. And there was a violent encounter there. It appeared to be Brazilian armed forces, but the actual, individuals with weapons haven't been identified. But there have been violent encounters, probably with, you know, the blessing of someone in government. It's hard to say exactly who that would be, but What's certain is that the government is presently attempting to develop the Tapajós River, which is much of which is considered the homeland of the Munduruku Indians. And the Munduruku are not happy about this, and they've been resisting quite forcefully, and have actually stopped the government recently from building the centerpiece of the dam that would have transformed the entire river valley. So I think we could say that, you know, the Brazilian government is interested in developing the region, and not so much in, you know, dispossessing indigenous peoples. They want to develop the region. Now, you know, the fact of the matter is, the drive to develop this will come into conflict with, you know, indigenous issues or indigenous territories in particular, indigenous rights. So, you know, there is a, you know, a dramatic and unwelcome consequence to the developmental drive, which is the dispossession of the Amerindians.
Well, I mean, we see it everywhere in the world, and in this country, too, conflict between environmental preservation and economic development, right? It's an age-old problem. So, Bob, we just have a minute or so left, so if you can do it in a nutshell, a small one, too. What's the state of Amazonia now? Does complete destruction and development seem inevitable throughout the whole vast region to you, from your perspective?
Well, sometimes I think it is, especially with respect to this new program of infrastructure development. The governments of UNASUR, the South American trading bloc, wish to turn Amazonia into a multimodal transportation hub and a continental source of hydropower. So there's a huge push to dam every river and to bring industrial development to the cities there, which would have it would destroy Amazonia as we know it today, probably precipitating what we call a tipping point transgression, where you would destroy the rain cycling of the forest, and the entire basin would convert to a fire adapted savanna. So, if that, you know, having said that, if that proceeds as it seems to be proceeding, it's a very pessimistic future. Now, having said that, you know, I don't think people are aware of these new programs, and at the same time, I think if people became aware, they might step out in front of it. And I think if they take inspiration from tribal peoples such as the Munduruku, they could actually put some brakes on the process. So I'm pessimistic, but hopeful at the same time. And one thing's for certain, we'll know for sure within the next 10 years whether Amazonia will be destroyed or conserved.
Well, this is one of those topics we'd love to have more time to talk with you more about, but we're going to have to leave it there. So I just want to say in one article of yours that I read online, Bob, you said, "The comfort of meditating on my past experiences will soon trump the adventure of accumulating new ones, but not today." So I'd say you're still an adventurer who's kind of an eco-warrior, and good for you. We hope you keep it up for a good while longer. Thanks for being on with us.
Court, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
But what I want to say, if you want to find out more about Robert Walker's work, just Google Robert Walker, Amazon Research, and you'll find lots of hits on his articles and what he does and more elaboration on what we've been talking about here. I want to thank all of you for listening today. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.